The surround of towering cliffs and trees made it difficult for large vessels to hover or land outside the perimeter of the landing platform. The lake that fronted Kachirho was expansive enough to accommodate a Victory-class Star Destroyer, but a subsequent offensive would entail storming the shoreline, as the Separatists had attempted to do. And Kachirho, at almost 400 meters in height, presented a formidable battlement. Natural fortresses, rosher trees, not only deflected ordinary blaster bolts, but also provided hundreds of defensive platforms. More important, trees that had endured for thousands of years were not easily burned, let alone uprooted or felled. Without employing turbo lasers and resigning themselves to massive death tolls, Imperial forces faced a grueling battle. Judging by the manner in which they had deployed the gunships and troop carriers, Kashyyyk's theater commanders were relying on the fact that the Wookiees had no ranged weapons and little in the way of anti-aircraft defense. But the Imperials had failed to take into account the thousands of war machines that had been abandoned by Separatist and Republic forces alike, following the fierce engagement on the Wawat Archipelago. Tank droids, missile platforms, spider and crab droids, all-terrain walkers, and juggernauts. And just now, the Wookiees were putting all that they had salvaged to good use. Imperial gunships were unable to descend below treetop level without the risk of being blown from the sky by commandeered artillery that had been moved to Kachirho's loftiest platforms, or by fluttercraft retrofitted with laser cannons. Closer to the ground, those gunships that succeeded in evading the fire and flak found themselves set upon by flights of catamarans mounted with rocket launchers and repeating blasters. Troopers attempting to repel from incapacitated ships were picked off by hails of bowcaster quarrels, blaster bolts fired from rifles taller than Starstone, sometimes bands of Wookiees swinging out from the Tree City platforms on braided vines. The few troopers who survived the airborne barrages and reached the ground faced focused fire from blaster nests high in the trees, volleys of grenades, and showers of red-hot debris sizzling down through the leafy canopy. Fighting alongside Tarful, Chewbacca, and hundreds of Wookiee warriors, Starstone and the other Jedi were still involved in the chaotic fray on the landing platform. Employing carved shields and eccentric blasters, Wookiee females fought as ferociously as the males, and many of the off-world merchants were pitching in, recognizing that the Empire had no intention of sparing them. Weapons cleverly concealed in dropships and transports were targeting anything the Wookiees missed, and many ferries were racing up the well, intent on carrying entire Wookiee families to safety. In areas where there were lulls in the fighting, many Wookiee females and younglings were falling back toward the Tree City, or evacuating Kachirho's lower levels for the refuge of the High Forest. Starstone wondered just how much the Empire was willing to risk at Kashyyyk. Had Palpatine's minions considered that faced with captivity, the Wookiees might flee their arboreal cities and become a rebel force the likes of which the Grand Army had yet to confront? The thought provided her with a moment of solace. Then she glimpsed something that sent her heart racing. Sensing her sudden distraction, Forte and Kalka followed her gaze to mid-level Kachirho, where a black Imperial shuttle was drifting in for a landing on one of the Tree City's enormous balconies.
"It's Vader!"
Starstone said when the two Jedi Knights asked. Leading an exodus of women and younglings from Kachirho's lowest levels, Chewbacca thought about his own family in distant Ruwukuroro, which apparently was also under siege. Ruwukuroro was days away on foot, but only minutes by ship. He would get there one way or another. Off to his left, the six Jedi who had been fighting alongside him for the better part of a local hour were suddenly racing back toward Kachirho's central rosher. Lifting his eyes, Chewbacca saw no significant threat, save for a Theta-class shuttle that was taking heavy fire as it attempted to fold its wings and settle on one of the Tree City balconies. Higher up, the sky was crisscrossed by laser fire and contrails, and still filling with gunships, eerily reminiscent of what had happened only weeks earlier when the Separatists had launched their invasion. The sheer number of descending gunships gave evidence of a sizable flotilla of capital ships in orbit. For all the Wookiee's success in repelling the first wave, it was surely only a matter of time before the Star Destroyers would open fire. And then, only a matter of time until Kashyyyk fell. Back and hip packs bulging with survival food and rations, Wookiees were streaming down the city staircases, racing across the footbridges, and disappearing into the thick vegetation that surrounded the lake. Blazed as a defense against sneak attacks by Trandoshan slavers, hundreds of well-maintained evacuation routes, cached with arms and supplies, radiated from Kachirho and wove through the isolated rock outcroppings to the high forest beyond. Targeted by unexpected anti-aircraft fire, Vader's shuttle jinked for the largest of Kachirho's arboreal balconies. Its powerful defensive shields raised, and its quad lasers spewing unrelenting fire at a pair of hailfire droids the Wookiees had hoisted into their massive tree fortress. Bolts from the shuttle's forward weapons reduced the missile platforms to slagged heaps and chewed into the balcony's wooden columns and beams, filling the air with splinters hard as nails. The explosions flung the bodies of Kachirho's furry defenders far and wide. Hurled clear off the tier, some plummeted to the ground 100 meters below. In the cabin space of the shaken shuttle, Vader was being addressed by the holo image of one of the task force commanders.
Our circumspect attacks are being repulsed planet-wide, Lord Vader. As I thought I made clear, Wookiees do not take lightly to the threat of captivity. Already they're abandoning the tree cities for the high forests. If they penetrate deeply enough, we will need months, perhaps years, to find and root them out. Even then, the cost to us will be great in terms of material and lives.
Vader muted the holoprojector's audio pickup and glanced across the aisle to Commander Apo.
Do you concur, Commander?
As it is, we're losing too many troopers,
Apo said without hesitation.
Grant permission to the naval commanders to initiate surgical bombardment from orbit.
Vader mulled it over for a moment. He didn't like being wrong, much less admitting that he'd been wrong, but he saw no way out.
You may commence bombardment, Commander, but make certain you save Kachirho for last. I have business to finish up here.
Wings uplifted, the shuttle made a rough landing on the tier, bolts from Wookiee blasters careening from the fuselage. When the boarding ramp had extended, Apo and his stormtroopers hurried outside, Vader right behind him, his ignited blade deflecting fire from all sides. Three troopers fell before they made it 2 meters from the ramp. The Wookiees were dug in, shooting from behind makeshift barricades and from crossbeams high above the balcony. Raising the shuttle on repulsor lift power, the clone pilot took the craft through a 180-degree sweep, drenching the area with laser fire. At the same time, two Wookiees with satchel charges slung over their shoulders rushed from cover and managed to hurl the explosives through the shuttle's open hatch. A deafening explosion blew off one of the wings and sent the craft spinning and skidding to the very rim of the tier. Counterattacking, Vader strode through fountaining flames to take the fight to the Wookiees. Crimson blade slashing left and right, he parried blaster bolts and amputated limbs and heads. Caterwauling and howling, showing their fangs and waving their long arms about, the Wookiees tried to hold their positions, but they had never faced anything like him, even in the darkest depths of Kashyyyk's primeval forest. As tall as some of them, Vader waded in, his lightsaber cleaving intricately carved war shields, sending blasters and bowcasters flying, setting fire to shaggy coats, leaving more than a score of bodies in his wake. He was waving Apo and the other troopers forward when flashes of refulgent blue light caught his eye and he swung to the source. Emerging from a covered bridge, anchored distally to the bole of the giant tree, rushed six Jedi, deflecting blaster bolts from the stormtroopers as they attacked, doing to Apo's cadre just what Vader had done to the Wookiees. Forging through the offensive, three Jedi raced in to square off with Vader. He recognized the petite black-haired female among them and tipped his blade in salute.
You've saved me the trouble of looking for you, Padawan Starstone. These others must be the ones you gathered by accessing the Temple Beacon.
Starstone's dark eyes bored into him. You defiled the temple by setting foot in it.
More than you know.
Then you'll pay for that as well. He angled the lightsaber in front of him, tip pointed slightly downward.
You're very much mistaken, Padawan. It is you who will pay.
Before Starstone could make a move, Cy-Adam Forte and Iwokulka stepped in front of her and attacked Vader. As was the case with many Jedi Knights, the two were familiar with accounts of what had happened on Geonosis when Obi-Wan Kenobi and Anakin Skywalker had gone after the Sith Lord Count Dooku. And so Forte and Kulka went in as a team, each of them employing a radically different lightsaber style, determined to off-balance Vader. But Vader merely stood like a statue, his blade angled toward the ground, until the very instant the two Jedi unleashed their assault. Then, as the three blades joined in scatterings of dazzling light and grating static sounds, he moved. Forte and Kulka were skilled duelists, but Vader was not only faster than Starstone remembered him being on Mirkana against Master Shatak, but also more agile. He employed his awesome power to put a quick end to the fancy twirling of his opponents, who fell back against the hammering blows of Vader's bloodshine blade. Time and again, the two Jedi Knights attempted to alter their style, but Vader had an answer for every lunge, parry, and riposte. His style borrowed elements from all techniques of combat, even from the highest, most dangerous levels, and his moves were crisp and unpredictable. In addition, his remarkable foresight allowed him to anticipate Forte's and Kulka's strategies and maneuvers. His blade always one step ahead of theirs, notwithstanding the two-handed grip he employed. Toying with the Jedi, he grazed Forte on the left shoulder, then on the right thigh. Kulka, he pierced lightly in the abdomen, then shaved away the flesh on the right side of the Hoden's face. Seeing the two Jedi Knights dropped their knees, wincing in pain, Padawan Klossi Ano broke from where she was helping Jambe and Nam engage the stormtroopers and got to Vader one step ahead of Starstone. Sidestepping, Vader slashed her across the back, sending her sprawling across the balcony. Then he whirled on Forte and Kulka, just as they were clambering to their feet, and decapitated them. From behind Vader came Jambe and Nam, neither of whom was an experienced fighter, and both of whom Vader immediately eliminated from the fight, amputating Jambe's right arm and Nam's right leg. To her horror, Starstone realized she was suddenly alone with Vader, who immediately signaled his stormtroopers to leave her to him, and to devote themselves to slaughtering the few Wookiees who remained on the tier.
"Now you, Padawan," he said as he began to circle her.
Calling on the Force, Starstone fell on him in a fury, striking wildly and repeatedly and with anger. Moments into her attack, she understood that Vader was merely allowing her to vent, as the Temple Swordmaster had often done with students, allowing them to believe that they were driving him back, when in fact, he was simply encouraging them to wear themselves out before disarming them in one rapid motion. So she retreated, altering her strategy and calming herself. "Vader is so tall, so imposing. But perhaps I can get under or inside his guard as Master Shatak did."
"Your thoughts give you away, Padawan. You mustn't take the time to think. You must act on impulse. Instead of repressing your anger, call on it. Make use of it to defeat me."
Starstone feigned an attack, then sidestepped and slashed at him. Shifting to a one-handed hold on his lightsaber, he parried her blade and lunged forward. She snapped aside in the nick of time, but he kept coming at her, answering her increasingly frantic strikes with harsher ones and driving her inexorably toward the rim of the balcony. He flicked his blade precisely, economically, forcing her back and back. She felt as if she were fighting a droid, although a droid programmed to counter all her best stratagems. Ducking out from under a broad sweep of the crimson blade, she somersaulted to safety, but only for a moment.
"You're skittish, Padawan."
Sweat dripped into her eyes. She tried to center herself in the Force. At the same time, she was vaguely aware of a new sound in the air, cutting through the chaos of the battle below. And just then, a familiar ship slammed down on the tier alongside the crippled shuttle. Two equally familiar figures leaping from the hatch, even while the ship was still in motion. At once, and seemingly of its own accord, the blood-smeared hilt of Master Forte's lightsaber shot from the balcony floor, whizzing past Vader's masked face to snap into the hand of one of the figures and ignite. A gurgled sound issued from somewhere close to the newly arrived ship, and something metallic hit the floor and began to roll forward. His black cloak unfurling, Vader spun around to find the helmeted head of Commander Apo coming to a rocky rest at his feet. A few meters away, Rhone Shrine stood with his legs spread to shoulder width. Forte's blue blade angled high and to one side. Alongside him, blasters in both six-fingered hands, Archer was dropping every stormtrooper who approached.
"Get away from him!"
Shrine yelled at Starstone. She gaped at him.
How did you...
Philly was keeping us updated. Now move away! Hurry!
Vader made no effort to prevent her from slinking past him.
Very touching, Shrine. Treating her like your personal learner.
Shrine gestured broadly.
Oli, get the wounded into the dropship!
Advancing on Vader, he said,
I'm the one you want, Vader. So here's your chance. Me for them.
Shrine, no! Starstone started.
Take the wounded! He cut her off. Jula's waiting. I'm not leaving you! I'll catch up with you when I'm done with him.
Vader looked from Shrine to Starstone.
Listen to your master, Padawan. He has already lost two learners. I'm certain he doesn't want to lose a third.
Coming back to herself, Starstone hurried to help Lambe, Klossy, Nam, and some of the Wookiees get aboard the dropship. Determined to quiet her fears for Shrine, she forced herself not to look at him, but she could feel him reaching out to her. He is a Jedi again, she thought. With gunships circling Kachiro, like insects spilled from an aggravated nest, Skek powered the dropship over the edge of the balcony and dived for the beleaguered landing platform. Airbursts from Imperial artillery crawlers raked and scorched the ship, inside which Starstone sat slumped on her knees with an arm around Klossy Ano, who was going in and out of consciousness, the wound on her back like a blackened trench. Across the cramped passenger bay, Lambe and Nam, white-faced with fear, were nursing their amputated limbs and calling on the Force to keep from going into shock. Wookiees huddled, braying in anger or whimpering in pain. Two of those Starstone and Archer had helped carry aboard were dead.
Hold tight!
Archer yelled from the dropship's co-pilot seat.
This'll be one to remember!
Skek was taking the ship in fast. While the impaired repulsors were managing to keep it airborne, the ship was tipped acutely to one side. As a result, the wing on that side made first contact with the platform, gouging a ragged furrow in the wooden surface and whipping the ship into a spin that sent it crashing into a parked ferry in even sorrier condition. Starstone's head slammed against the bulkhead with such force that she saw stars. Setting Klossy down gently, she checked on Lambe and Nam. Then she stumbled through the dropship hatch, with Archer trailing while Skek remained at the controls. Daylight was fading, and the air was filled with the smoke and grit of battle. The sky wailed with ships and pulsed with strobing explosions. Wookiees and other beings were running every which way across the landing platform. Elsewhere, bands of Wookiees, including some of those the Jedi had met, were carrying the wounded to shelter. Many of the traitor's ships had lifted off, but just as many had been savaged by gunship fire or buried under debris that had fallen from Kachiro's uppermost limbs and branches. Principal fighting had moved east of the platform, closer to the lake. Her head swimming, Starstone steadied herself against the dropship's tipped fin. Out of billowing smoke came Philly, running in a crouch and leading Dara Naluo by her left hand. Converging on Starstone from another direction appeared Cudgel and a dozen or so Wookiees, Chewbacca among them, some of them limping, some with blood-matted fur.
"Where are the others?"
Philly asked her, loud enough to be heard above the maelstrom of smoke and fire. She motioned to the dropship.
"Skek, Lambe, Nam, and Klossy are inside."
"Forte?" Philly said.
"Kalka?"
"Dead." Dara Nalual hung her head and clutched onto Philly's arm.
"Shrine?"
Wide-eyed, she gazed up at the balcony as if just recalling him.
"Up there."
Philly's eyes remained on her.
"The drunk dancer's upside. You ready to leave?"
She stared at him.
"Leave?"
He nodded.
"Try to, anyway. If we're gonna survive this, the sooner we're airborne, the better."
Starstone swept her eyes over the ruined landing platform. "We take as many as we can with us." Overhearing her, Cudgel began gesticulating to the Wookiees with whom he'd arrived.
"Chewbacca, pack the dropship and the transport. Get everyone you can inside."
Others heard her as well, and it wasn't long before dozens of Wookiees began to press forward. Shortly, the area was crowded with more Wookiees and traders than the two ships could possibly accommodate. But in the midst of the mad crush for space aboard the craft, Imperial gunships abruptly began to break off their attack on Kachirho. The reason for the sudden withdrawal was soon made clear, as colossal turbolaser beams lanced from the sky, scorching areas of the surrounding forests into which thousands of Wookiees had fled. With great booming sounds, giant limbs broke from the rochers, and hot wind and flame swept over the landing platform, setting fire to nearly everything flammable. With explosive sounds rumbling, Wookiees ran screaming from the forest, fur singed, blackened, or ablaze. It took Starstone a moment to realize that she was flat on her back on the landing platform. Picking herself up, hair blowing in a hot, foul-smelling wind, she struggled to her feet in time to hear Cudgel say,
"Orbital barrage!"
The rest of his words were subsumed in a thunderous noise that commenced in the upper reaches of Kachirho, as dozens of huge limbs fractured and fell, plummeting into the lake and flattening acres of shoreline vegetation. Suddenly, Archer was tapping her on the shoulder.
"Oli, we're as full as we can be and still be able to lift off."
She nodded by rote. Philly turned and started back toward the transport, only to stop, swing around, and show her an alarmed look.
"Wait! Who's going to fly that thing?"
She gaped at him.
"I thought, I'm no pilot. What about Lambe or Nam?"
She shook her head back and forth.
"They're in no shape."
Scanning everyone, her gaze fell on Cudgel.
"Can you pilot the transport?"
He gestured to himself in incredulity.
"Sure, providing you don't care about being shot out of the air as soon as we launch."
Her dread mounted, the rush of blood pounding in her ears.
"I can't leave everyone here."
All at once, Cudgel was calling to her and motioning Chewbacca forward.
"Chewbacca can pilot the transport."
She shot the Wookiee a dubious glance, then looked to Cudgel for assurance.
"Can he even fit?"
Chewbacca barked and brayed to Cudgel.
"He'll do the piloting in return for your allowing him to take the transport back down the well to Ruukaroro,"
Cudgel explained.
"His home village. He has family there."
Starstone was already nodding.
"Of course he can."
"Everyone on board!"
Archer yelled.
"Seal him up!"
"I was rather fond of Commander Apo,"
Vader said, towing the amputated head of the clone officer out of his path as he moved closer to Shrine. Shrine tightened his grip on the hilt of Forte's lightsaber and sidestepped cautiously to the left, forcing Vader to adjust his course.
"I felt the same about Bolsh Attack."
"Tell me, Shrine, are you the trap the others hope to spring on me?"
Shrine continued to circle Vader.
"I wasn't even part of their plan. In fact, I tried to talk them out of doing something like this."
"But in the end, you just couldn't stay away. Even if it meant abandoning what might have been a lucrative career as a smuggler."
Losing Senator Fang Zhar was a blow to our reputation. I figured I'd better eliminate the competition.
Yes.
Vader said, raising his blade somewhat.
I am your worst rival.
Lightsaber grasped in both hands, Vader took a single forward step and performed a lightning-fast underhand sweep that almost knocked Forte's lightsaber from Shrine's grip. Spinning, Shrine regained his balance and raced forward, feinting a diagonal slash from the left, then twisting the blade around to the right and surging forward. The blade might have gotten past Vader's guard, but instead, it glanced off the back of his upraised left hand, smoke curling from the black glove. Shrine countered quickly with an upsweep to Vader's neck, but Vader spun to the right, his blade held straight out in front of him as he completed a circle, nearly cutting Shrine in half. Folding himself at the waist, Shrine skittered backward, parrying a rapid series of curt but powerful slashes. Backflipping out of range, he twisted his body to the right, set the blade over his right shoulder, and rushed forward, hammering away. Vader deflected the blows without altering his stance or giving ground, and in the process, left his lower trunk and legs unprotected. In a blink, Shrine dropped into a crouch and pivoted through a turn. For an instant, it seemed that the blade was going to pass clear through Vader's knees. But Vader leapt high, half twisting in midair and coming down behind Shrine. Shrine rolled as Vader's crimson shaft struck the floor at the spot he had just vacated. Scrambling to his feet, Shrine hurled himself forward, catching Vader in the right forearm. Snarling, Vader took his left hand from the lightsaber hilt to dampen sparking at the sight of what should have been a wound. Astonishment eclipsed Shrine's follow-up attack. I know you don't have a heart, he said, taking stalking steps. But I didn't realize that you're all droid. Vader may have been about to reply when packets of blinding light speared through the balcony, opening holes 10 meters across. The great Rosher shook as if struck by the full force of a lightning storm, and branches and leaves rained down on what was left of the deck. With a loud splitting sound, a large section of the rim broke away, taking Vader's shuttle with it. There goes your ride home, Shrine said when he could. Guess you're stuck here with me. Vader was a good distance away, one hand and one knee pressed to the floor, his blade angled away from him. Slowly, he stood to his full height, leaves falling around him, black cloak flapping in the downdrafts. Then, with determined strides, he advanced on Shrine, sweeping his blade from side to side.
I wouldn't have it any other way.
Shrine took a quick look around. With most of the tier behind him blown away and gaping holes elsewhere, he began to back toward the hollowed trunk of the tree.
Almost seems like your own people are trying to kill you, Vader, he said. Maybe they don't like the idea of a Sith influencing the Emperor.
Vader continued his resolute march.
Trust me, Shrine. The Emperor couldn't be more pleased.
Shrine cast a quick glance over his shoulder. They were entering an enormous interior space of wooden ramps, walkways, bridges, and concourses.
He doesn't have enough experience with your kind.
And you do.
Enough to know that you'll turn on him eventually.
Vader loosed what could have been a laugh.
What makes you think the Emperor won't turn on me first?
Like he turned on the Jedi, Shrine said. Although I suspect that was mostly your doing. 5 meters away, Vader stopped short.
Mine?
You convinced him that with you by his side, he could get away with just about anything. Again, Vader's exhalation approximated a laugh.
It's thinking like that that blinded the Jedi to their fate.
He raised his sword.
Now it's time for you to join them.
Vader closed the distance between them in a heartbeat, slashing left and right with potent vertical strokes, narrowly missing Shrine time and again, but destroying everything touched by the blade. No whirling now, no windmilling or deft lunges. He simply used his bulk and size to remain wedded to the floor. It was an old style, the very opposite of what was said to have been Dooku style, and Shrine had no defense against it.
If I could see his face, his eyes, Shrine found time to think.
If he could knock that outsized helmet from Vader's head, if he could lance his lightsaber through the control panel on Vader's chest, that was the key. That was the reason for Vader's antique style, to protect his center, as Grievous had been forced to do. If he could only get to that control panel. The two craft lifted off into smoke and withering night, spiraling up through resuming enemy fire toward Kachirho's mid-level balconies. In the transport's cramped cockpit with Cudgel, Philly, and Chewbacca wedged into his seat, his head grazing the ceiling, Starstone clenched her white-knuckled hands on the shaking arms of the acceleration chair. She couldn't bring herself to lift her gaze to the viewports, for fear of what sights might greet her. As if reading her mind, Cudgel said, "You can't save an entire planet, kid. And it's not like you didn't try." Chewbacca reinforced the remark with a gutsy bass rumble, repeatedly slamming his huge hands down on the transport's control yoke for emphasis. "The Wookiees knew that their days of freedom were numbered," Cudgel translated. "Kashyyyk will only be the first non-human world to be enslaved." Chewbacca threw the weary transport through a sudden evasive turn, nearly spilling everyone from their chairs. Through the viewport, Starstone caught a glimpse of Vader's black shuttle tumbling toward the ground. Firewalling the throttle, Chewbacca clawed for altitude, barely escaping the flames of the crashed shuttle's mushrooming fireball. Archer's voice issued through the cockpit annunciators as the dropship appeared in the starboard panel of the viewport.
"Close call!"
Growling irritably, Chewbacca ran a fast systems check.
"Tail singed," Cudgel told Archer through the comlink. "But everything else is intact."
The dropship remained in view to starboard. Dodging fire, the two ships raced into a burnt orange sunset and climbed for the stars, mingling with scores of escaping ferries and cargo haulers. Turbo laser bolts rained down from ships in orbit, and across the darkening curve of the planet, fires raged. Lowing in anguish and pounding one giant fist on the instrument panel, Chewbacca pointed to a bright burning in the canopy.
"Rawookaroro," Cudgel said. "Chewbacca's tree village."
The stars were just losing their shimmer when the communication suite toned. Philly routed the transmission through the cockpit speakers.
"Glad to see you've come to your senses," Jula said. "Is Roan with either of you?"
"Negative, Jula,"
Philly said sadly. Save for bursts of static, the annunciator remained silent for a long moment. Then Jula's voice returned.
"After Alderaan, there was nothing I could say."
Her words trailed off, but she wasn't finished.
"None of us is out of this yet anyway. Vader, or whoever's in charge, has interdictor cruisers parked in orbit. No ships have been able to jump to hyperspace."
"Does the drunk dancer have enough firepower to take on the cruiser?" Cudgel asked.
"Philly,"
Jula said,
"inform whoever asked that question that I'm not about to go to guns with a detainer CC-2200.
As the transport reached the edge of Kashyyyk's envelope, magnified views of local space showed hundreds of ships trapped in the artificial gravity well, generated by the interdictor's powerful projectors. Interspersed among the ensnared vessels drifted the blackened husks of separatist warships that had been there since the end of the war.
"Too bad we can't start up one of those SEP destroyers," Cudgel lamented. "They have guns enough to deal with that cruiser."
Starstone and Philly looked at each other.
"We might know a way," he said.
Shrine's slashing strike to Vader's lower left leg, owing as much to luck as to skill, released another shower of sparks. Vader's enraged response was Shrine's only assurance that he was fighting a living being. Whatever had happened to Vader, by accident or volition, he had to be more flesh and blood than cyborg, or he wouldn't have raged or been able to call on the Force with such intensity. High up in the smoke-filled lattice-like room, they stood facing each other on a suspension bridge that linked two fully enclosed walkways, the gloom cut by shafts of explosive light from the continuing attack on Kachirho. Artificial limbs and body armor seem a curious choice for a Sith, Shrine said, poised for Vader's riposte to his lucky strike. Belittling to the dark side. Vader adjusted his grip on the sword and advanced.
No more than throwing in with smugglers denigrates the Force, Shrine.
Ah, but I saw the light. Maybe it's time you did.
You have it backward.
Shrine was steeling himself for a lunging attack, when abruptly, Vader halted and withdrew the blade into the lightsaber's hilt. Before Shrine could begin to make sense of it, he heard a creaking sound from below, and something flew at him from one of the ramps. Only a last instant turn of his sword kept the object from striking him in the head. It was a plank, ripped from a ramp they had taken to the bridge. Shrine gazed in awe at unreadable Vader, then began to race toward him, blade held high over his right shoulder. He didn't make half the distance when a storm of similar planks and lengths of handrail came whirling at him. Vader was using his dark side abilities to dismantle the ramps. Surrendering to the guidance of the Force, Shrine swung his lightsaber in a flurry of deflecting maneuvers. Side to side, overhead, low down, behind his back. But the floorboards were coming in larger and larger pieces from all directions and faster than he could parry them. The butt end of a board struck him on the outer left thigh. The face of a wide plank slammed him across the shoulders. Wooden pegs flew at his face, others speared into his arms. Then, a short support post hit him squarely in the forehead, knocking the wind out of him and dropping him to his knees. Blood running into his eyes, he fought to remain conscious, extending the lightsaber in one shaking hand while clamping the other on the bridge's handrail. 5 meters away, Vader stood, his hands crossed in front of him, lightsaber hanging on his belt. Shrine tried to keep him in focus. Another board, whirling end over end, came out of nowhere, hitting him in the kidneys. Reflexively, the hand that was grasping the railing went to the small of his back, and he lost balance. Trying but failing to catch himself, he fell through space. Give in the wooden floor saved his life, but at the expense of all the bones in his left arm and shoulder. Above him, Vader jumped from the bridge, dropping to the floor with a grace he hadn't displayed before, and alighting just meters away. Ignoring the pain in his shattered limb, Shrine began to propel himself in a backward crawl toward the opening through which he and Vader had entered the Rosher's trunk, a hot wind howling at him, whipping his long hair about. The balcony was gone. Fallen. There was nothing between Shrine and the ground but gritty air filled with burning leaves. Far below, Wookiees were being herded onto the landing platform. The forests were in flames. Vader approached, drawing and igniting his Sith blade. Shrine blinked blood from his eyes, lifted his lightsaber hand only to realize that he had lost the sword during his fall. Slumping back, he loosed a ragged, resigned exhalation. "I owe you a debt," he told Vader. "It took you to bring me back to the Force.
And you to firm my faith in the power of the dark side, Master Shrine."
Shrine swallowed hard. "Then tell me, were you trained by Dooku? By Sidious?" Vader came to a halt.
"Not by Dooku. Not yet by Sidious."
"Not yet," Shrine said as if to himself. "Then you're his apprentice." His eyes darted right and left, searching for some means of escape. "Is Sidious also in league with Emperor Palpatine?" Vader fell silent for a moment, making up his mind about something.
"Lord Sidious is the Emperor."
Shrine gaped at Vader, trying to make sense of what he had said. "The order to kill the Jedi."
"Order 66.
Sidious issued it." Pieces to the puzzle Shrine had been grappling with for weeks assembled themselves. The military buildup, the war itself, it was all part of a plan to eliminate the Jedi Order. Vader nodded.
"All about this.
He gestured to Shrine.
About you and me, you could say.
Shrine's stomach convulsed, and he coughed blood. The fall hadn't only broken his bones, but ruptured a vital organ. He was dying. Backing farther out the opening, he gazed into the night sky, then at Vader. Did Sidious turn you into the monstrosity you've become?
No, Shrine.
Vader said in a flat voice.
I did this to myself, with some help from Obi-Wan Kenobi.
Shrine stared. You knew Obi-Wan? Vader regarded him.
Haven't you guessed by now? I was a Jedi for a time.
Shrine let his bafflement show. You're one of the lost 20, like Dooku.
I am the 21st Master Shrine. Surely you've heard of Anakin Skywalker, the Chosen One.
The Commerce Guild ship Starstone and the others had chosen to infiltrate grew larger in the transport's cockpit viewports. Just over 1,000 meters in length and bristling with electromagnetic sensor antennas and point defense laser cannons, the Recusant class support destroyer had taken a turbo laser bruising during the Battle of Kashyyyk. But its principal cannons and trio of aft thrust nozzles appeared to be undamaged. Elsewhere, local space was dotted with Imperial landers and troop transports, along with hundreds of freighters that had fled the surface of the tormented planet. Central to the latter craft, and a good distance from the support destroyer, floated the interdictor cruiser that was preventing the traitor's ships from jumping to hyperspace. Those trapped ships are the reason I was spared, Starstone thought. The reason she had been rescued by Shrine. Any response from the droid brain? She asked over Philly's shoulder.
Well, we're chatting,
the slicer said from the cockpit's comm suite.
It recognized the code we used to activate the facility at Jaguda, but it refuses to accept any remote commands. My guess is that it was rudely shut down during the battle and wants to run a systems check before bringing the destroyer fully online.
Be best if we can keep from announcing ourselves,
Cudgel said from the co-pilot's chair.
You think you can keep the brain from lighting up the entire ship?
Not initially, Philly said. The brain will probably restore universal power gradually as part of its diagnostic analysis. Once that's over and done with, I can task it to kill all the running lights, except for those around the forward docking bay.
A sudden growl from Chewbacca called Starstone's attention to the forward viewports. Fore to aft, the pod-like warship was coming to life. Cudgel muttered a curse.
The interdictor scanners are bound to pick that up.
Just a couple of moments more, Philly said.
Everyone waited.
Done,
Philly announced. In reverse order, the destroyer's running lights began to blink out, save for an array of illuminators that defined the rectangular entrance to the docking bay. Philly flashed Starstone a grin.
The brain is being very cooperative. We're good to dock.
Chewbacca brayed an interrogative.
Any atmosphere?
Cudgel translated. Philly did rapid input at the keyboard.
The ship originally carried several squadrons of Vulture and droid tri-fighters, he said. But unless the Gossams converted it fully to droid operation, I'd expect there'd be atmosphere and artificial gravity in some areas.
His eyes darted to the display screen.
Looks like a bit of both. Gossam and droid crew.
Battle droids? Starstone said. Philly nodded.
Afraid so.
You can't shut them down?
Not without shutting down the command bridge.
Starstone frowned and turned to Cudgel. Gather up as many blasters as we've got aboard, and while you're at it, you'll find some rebreathers in the main cabin, just in case there's no atmosphere. Starstone was studying the destroyer when the dropship came alongside the transport. Without having to be told, Chewbacca decelerated and fell in behind the smaller craft. Starstone slipped into the vacant co-pilot's chair to watch the dropship glide into the bay. Almost immediately, blaster bolts crisscrossed the darkness. By the time the transport nosed through the opening, battle droids were dropping like targets in a shooting gallery, and the deck was strewn with spindly body parts. Rebreathers strapped to their faces, Lumas to their foreheads, Starstone, Cudgel, and Philly were standing at the boarding ramp hatch when Chewbacca set the transport down. Shortly, the Wookiee joined them there, the bowcaster he carried over his shoulder assembled and gripped in his hands. As the transport's outer hatch slid open, the harsh sibilance of blaster fire infiltrated the ship. Starstone and the others hurried out into the thick of the fighting, their headlamps casting long shadows all over the bay. Archer and several well-armed Wookiees were off to one side, clearing the path through battle droids toward a hatch in the bay's forward bulkhead. Firing on the run and hurtling pieces of disintegrated droids, Starstone, Philly, Cudgel, and Chewbacca made a desperate dash for the hatch. The corridor beyond was crowded with battle droids marching on to reinforce those in the docking bay. The explosive quarrels from Chewbacca's bowcaster, combined with blaster fire and deflections from Starstone's lightsaber, dropped a dozen droids at a time. But for every dozen destroyed, another dozen appeared. Archer and some of the Wookiees brought up the rear, ultimately allowing Starstone's contingent to shoot their way into a turbo lift that accessed the destroyer's outrigger arm. Prepared for the worst, the four of them burst onto the command bridge, only to find a group of befuddled humaniform technical droids, outfitted with power studs at the backs of the heads that allowed them to be quickly and methodically shut down. Realizing that the bridge had oxygen, everyone removed their rebreathers. Chewbacca dogged the hatch to the corridor, while Philly centered himself at the ship's control console and activated the bridge's emergency lights.
"Gossums have longer fingers than I have,"
he said in the scarlet glow of the illuminators.
"This could take some time."
"We're running short as it is," Cudgel said.
"Just get the main cannons enabled."
Battle droids on the far side of the sealed hatch were already trying to pound their way onto the bridge. Philly went back to work, but a moment later said,
"Uh-oh."
Chewbacca loosed a trolling roar at him.
"Uh-oh what?" Starstone asked.
Abruptly, the destroyer lurched and began to nose about toward Kashyyyk's crescent of bright side.
"The brain wants to complete the task it was in the middle of when the ship was shut down," Philly said.
Starstone turned to him.
"What was the task?"
"It thinks that the Separatists are losing Kachiro. It's converting itself into a giant bomb."
"Can't you retask it?"
"I'm trying. It won't listen."
Cudgel muttered to himself, and Chewbacca issued a sound that was somewhere between a growl and a groan.
"Philly!"
Starstone said sharply.
"Let the brain think what it wants. Just assign it a new target."
His blank stare yielded slowly to a grin of comprehension.
"Can do."
Starstone returned the smile, then glanced at Cudgel.
"Comlink the drunk dancer to prepare to receive guests."
As soon as Jula received word that the dropship and transport had exited the Commerce Guild warship, she left the drunk dancer in the capable hands of Broody Gain and Isle Dix and headed for the docking bay. Her eagerness sabotaged by the lightsaber gas she'd suffered on Alderaan, she moved slowly and carefully, arriving just as the two craft were drifting through the hatch. Forewarned that both were carrying injured, she had ordered the ship's med droids to rendezvous with her there. Forewarned, but not thoroughly enough to prepare her for the number of wounded evacuees who hobbled from the ships. Wookiees squeezing out like circus performers from an absurdly cramped vehicle, and many of them in grave condition. As for the Jedi, only 5 of the original 7 had survived, and just barely from the look of them. Jambe Lu, Nampurf, and Klossi Anno especially were in a lot worse shape than when they had first come aboard the Drunk Dancer, weeks earlier. Even the ship's med droids were dismayed.
"This may prove overwhelming, Captain,"
one of them said from behind Jula. "Do all you can," she told the droid. It was an unnerving sight, however, and she felt a bit panicked. But the tears she had been holding back since learning of Rhone's sacrifice didn't gush forth until she set eyes on Philly and Starstone. Seeing her standing distraught, crying into the palms of her hands, Starstone hurried over to wrap her in a comforting embrace. Jula allowed herself to be held for a long moment, but when she finally stepped out of the embrace, she saw that Starstone's cheeks were slick with tears, and that only got her crying again. Gently, she stroked the young woman's face. "What happened to avoiding attachment?" Jula said, sniffling. Starstone backhanded tears from her cheeks. "I've lost the skill. It doesn't seem to fit well with the Emperor's new order anyway." She held Jula's searching gaze. "Your son saved our lives. We tried to go back for him, but..." Jula averted her eyes. Someone had to try to stop Vader. In command of the detainer, parked above Kachiro, Captain Ugon normally refused to allow himself to be disturbed when he was on the bridge. But Ensign Newlip was so insistent about seeing him that he finally granted permission for the young technician to be escorted onto the command deck. A swarthy man with blunt features, Ugon remained seated in his chair, his dark gaze shifting between projected holo images of the invasion on Kashyyyk and the viewport panorama of the planet itself.
"Be quick about it," he warned Newlip.
"Yes, sir," the ensign promised. "It's simply that we've been monitoring some unusual readings from one of the Separatist ships that was left in orbit after the battle here. Specifically, a Commerce Guild Recusant-class support destroyer. I've tried repeatedly to convince someone in tactical to bring this to your attention, sir, but..."
Ugon cut him off. "What makes these readings unusual, Ensign?"
"They are initiation readings, sir." In response to the captain's dubious look, Newlip continued. "I know, sir, I was puzzled too. That's why I took it upon myself to check the scanner recordings. Much to my surprise, sir, I learned that the destroyer's central control computer had been remotely enabled to run a diagnostic, and then to bring several of the ship's systems online." When Ugon's expression of perplexity deepened, Newlip activated a small holoplate he had placed on the palm of his right hand. A grainy recording shone from the device. "You can see two craft entering the destroyer just here at the forwardmost docking bays." Newlip's forefinger fast-forwarded the recording. "Here, you can see the craft leaving. We're still trying to determine their destination." Ugon glanced from the recording to Newlip.
"Salvagers?"
"That was my first thought, sir. But in fact, when the craft exited, the destroyer itself was in motion." Ugon stared at him.
"In motion? What's its heading?"
"That's just it, sir. It's heading toward us." Turning to the forward viewports, Newlip indicated a dark shape moving through the greater darkness. "Just there, you see?" Ugon swiveled to an officer at the tactical duty station.
"A Separatist ship is approaching our port side. Scan it immediately."
Rising from his chair, he walked to the viewport, Newlip a step behind him.
"Captain," the tactical officer said. "The ship is a Confederacy droid-piloted support destroyer."
"I already know that," Ugon said, whirling around. "Does it pose any risk to us?"
"Checking, sir."
The officer spent a moment studying the duty station's array of display screens, then turned toward Ugon, ashen-faced.
"Captain, the destroyer's main reactor is in critical failure. The ship is effectively a massive bomb."
Shrine sprawled in the Rosher's cavernous opening, the wind tugging at his clothing, blood trickling from the corners of his mouth, clearly struggling with the revelation he'd been granted. Vader stood over him, his right hand resting on the hilt of the lightsaber, though he had no intention of drawing it from his belt again. One strong gust could topple Shrine to his final resting place.
"It is enough to let him die, knowing that the Order was betrayed by one of its own."
More important, Vader's bloodlust had been appeased, replaced by self-possession of a sort he had never before experienced.
It was as if he had crossed some invisible threshold to a new world. He could feel the power of the dark side surging through him like an icy torrent. He felt invulnerable in a way that had nothing to do with his Durasteel prostheses, his suit of armor and gadgets, which now seemed little more than an outfit. And it had taken a Jedi, yet another Jedi, to usher him over the threshold. He gazed down at Shrine, emblematic of the defeated Jedi Order, as Obi-Wan should have been. He recalled the way Dooku had gazed down at him on Geonosis, and the way Anakin had gazed down at Dooku in the General's quarters aboard the Invisible Hand. Shrine coughed weakly. "What are you waiting for, Skywalker? Strike me down. You're only killing a Jedi." Vader planted his fists on his hips.
"Then you do accept the truth."
"I accept that you and Palpatine are a perfect match," Shrine began, when without warning, an immense explosion turned a small region of the western sky bright as day. Eclipsing stars, a roiling ball of fire blossomed high over Kashyyyk, expanding and expanding until the vacuum of space suffocated it. When Vader looked at Shrine again, the Jedi appeared to be grinning.
"Would that be one of your ships? Your interdictor cruiser, maybe?"
He coughed blood in a laugh.
"They've escaped you again, haven't they?"
"If so, they will be found and killed."
Shrine's expression suddenly changed from smug to almost rapturous.
"I've seen this," he uttered, mostly to himself. "I envisioned this."
Vader pressed closer to hear him.
"Your death, you mean?"
"An explosion bright as a star," Shrine said. "A forest world. Intrepid defenders. Escaping ships. And you, I think, somehow at the center of it all."
His blood-stained lips formed themselves into a sublime smile, and a tear ran from his right eye.
"Skywalker, it won't matter if you find them. It won't matter if you find and kill every Jedi who survived Order 66. I understand now. The Force will never die."
Epilogue. 2 there should be, no more, no less. One to embody power, the other to crave it. Darth Bane.
"Lord Vader," the gunnery officer said, nodding his head in salute as Vader passed by his station.
"Lord Vader," the communications officer said, saluting in similar fashion.
"Lord Vader," the exactor's captain said, in crisp acknowledgement.
Vader continued on to the end of Bridge Walkway, thinking, "This is how I will be greeted from now on, wherever I set foot." Standing at the forward viewports, he scanned the stars with his reconstructed eyes. He had guardianship of all this, or at least, joint custody of it. The Jedi no longer mattered. They were no different from others who would interfere with his Insidious' realm. Their mission was to maintain order, so that the dark side could continue to reign supreme. Anakin was gone. A memory so deeply buried, he might have dreamed rather than lived it. The Force as Anakin knew it was interred with him, and inseparable from him. Just as Sidious promised, he was now married to the Order of the Sith, and needed no other companion than the dark side of the Force. He embraced all that he had done to bring balance to the Force, by dismantling the corrupt Republic and toppling the Jedi, and he reveled in his power. It could be all his, anything he wished. He needed only the determination to take it at whatever cost to those who stood in his way. But
He was also married to Sidious, who doled out precious bits of Sith technique as if merely lending them. Just enough to increase his apprentice's power, without making him supremely powerful. There would come a day, however, when they would be equals. He scanned the stars, looking forward to a time when he could find an apprentice of his own, and together, with that one, topple Darth Sidious from his throne. It gave him something to live for.
Another glass, stranger? The cantina owner asked Obi-Wan Kenobi.
What will it cost me?
10 credits for refills.
That's as much as a shot of one of your imported brandies.
The price of staying hydrated on Tatooine, my friend. Yes or no?
Obi-Wan nodded.
Fill it. Gathered by the cantina's single moisture vaporator, the water was somewhat cloudy and had a metallic taste, but it was of a higher quality than that gathered by Obi-Wan's own vaporator. If he was to survive in the hovel he had found, he would need to have the vaporator repaired or somehow obtain a newer one from the Jawa traders who occasionally passed through the region he now called home. If it hadn't been for the kindness of the maroon-cloaked creatures, he would still be walking to Anchorhead rather than sitting in the scant shade of the cantina's veranda, sipping water. A wind-scoured settlement close to Tatooine's western dune sea, Anchorhead was little more than a trading post, frequented by the moisture farmers who made up the Great Chott Salt Flat community, or by merchants traveling between Mos Eisley and Wayfar in the south. Anchorhead had a small resident population, a dozen or so poor stone stores, and 2 small cantinas. But it was known mainly for the power generator located at the edge of town. Named for its owner, Tashi Station supplied energy to the moisture farms and served as a recharge depot for the farmers' land speeders and other repulsor lift vehicles. The station also boasted a hyperwave repeater, which, when it functioned, received holonet feeds relayed from Naboo, Rodia, and occasionally Nal Hutta in Hutt space. Tashi was working today, and the weary traveler's handful of afternoon customers were catching up on news and the outcome of sports events that had taken place standard weeks earlier. Obi-Wan, known locally as Ben, had taken possession of an abandoned home on a bluff in the Jundland wastes. He glanced at the holonet display from time to time, but the focus of his interest was a provision store across the street from the cantina. In the months since he'd arrived on Tatooine, his hair and beard had grown quickly, and his face and hands had turned nut brown. In his soft boots and long robe, its cowl raised over his head, no one would have taken him for a former Jedi, let alone a master who had sat on the High Council. In any case, Tatooine wasn't a world where questions were asked. Residents wondered, and they gossiped and theorized, but they rarely inquired about the reasons that brought strangers to remote Tatooine. Coupled with the fact that the world was still largely under the sway of the Hutts, the prevailing frontier etiquette had made Tatooine a refuge for criminals, smugglers, and outlaws from star systems galaxy-wide. Months earlier, when he and Anakin had been in pursuit of clues they'd hoped would lead them to Darth Sidious, Obi-Wan had told Anakin that he could think of far worse places to live than Tatooine, and he still felt that way. He took in stride the ubiquitous sand that had so rankled Anakin. Tatooine's double sunset skies were always a marvel to behold, and the isolation suited him. All the more because Anakin had been subverted by Palpatine, and for a brief time had served this new emperor. Given everything that had happened since, the one image Obi-Wan knew he would never be able to erase from his memory was that of Anakin, Darth Vader, as Sidious had dubbed him, kneeling in allegiance to the Dark Lord after having gone on a murderous spree in the Jedi Temple. If there was a second image, it was of Anakin burning on the shore of one of Mustafar's lava flows, cursing him. Had he been wrong to let Anakin die there? Could he have been redeemed as Padme had believed to the last? These were questions that plagued him and pained him more deeply than he would ever have thought possible. And now, all these months later, here he was on Tatooine, Anakin's homeworld, watching over Anakin's infant son, Luke. Obi-Wan's reason for living. Watching from afar, at any rate. Today was as close as he had come to the child in weeks. Just across the street, Luke sat in a front carrier worn by Beru while she purchased sugar and blue milk. Neither she nor her husband Owen was aware of Obi-Wan's presence on the cantina veranda, his vigilant, though covert, gaze. As Obi-Wan brought the water glass to his mouth and sipped, a HoloNet news report caught his ear and he swung to the cantina's display, simultaneous with a torrent of static that interrupted the feed. "What was she saying?" Obi-Wan asked a human seated two tables away.
"Band of Jedi were killed on Kashyyyk," the man said.
Close to Obi-Wan's age, he wore utilities of the sort affected by docking bay workers in Mos Eisley spaceport. Had the HoloNet reporter been referring to Jedi who'd been on Kashyyyk with Yoda? No, Obi-Wan realized, when the feed suddenly returned. The reporter was talking about more recent events. About Jedi who had obviously survived Order 66 and been discovered on Kashyyyk. He continued to listen, growing colder and colder inside. The Empire had accused Kashyyyk of plotting rebellion. Thousands of Wookiees had died. Hundreds of thousands more had been imprisoned. Obi-Wan squeezed his eyes shut in dismay. He and Yoda had recalibrated the temple beacon to warn surviving Jedi away from Coruscant. What could the ones discovered on Kashyyyk have been thinking? Banding together like that? Drawing attention to themselves instead of going to ground as they had been ordered to do? Did they think they could gather enough strength to go after Palpatine? Of course they did, Obi-Wan realized. They hadn't realized that Palpatine had manipulated the war. That a Sith occupied the throne. That, like everyone else, the Jedi had failed to grasp a truth that should have been evident years earlier. The Republic had never been worth fighting for. The ideals of democracy hadn't been stamped out by Palpatine. The Jedi had carried out missions of dubious merit for any number of Supreme Chancellors, but always in the name of safeguarding peace and justice. What they had failed to understand was that the Senate, the Coruscanti, the citizens of countless world and star systems, grown weary of the old system, had allowed democracy to die. And in a galaxy where the goal was single-minded control from the top, and where in the end justified the means, the Jedi had no place. That had been the final revenge of the Sith. When Obi-Wan lifted his gaze, the intermittently garbled HoloNet was displaying an image of someone outfitted in what almost seemed a costume of head-to-toe black. Human or humanoid, the being's species wasn't mentioned. The masked Imperial had apparently played a role in tracking down and executing the insurrectionist Jedi and enslaving their Wookiee confederates. The burst of static that accompanied the reporter's mention of the figure's identity might have surged from Obi-Wan's brain. Still chilled by the earlier announcement about the Jedi, he was now paralyzed by sudden dread. He couldn't have heard what he thought he heard. He whirled to the spaceport worker. "What did she say? Who is that?"
"Lord Vader," the man said, all but into his glass of brandy.
Obi-Wan shook his head. "No, that's not possible."
"You didn't ask if I thought it was possible, Sandman. You asked me what she said."
Obi-Wan stood up in a daze, knocking over his table.
"Hey, take it easy, friend," the man said, rising.
"Vader," Obi-Wan muttered. "Vader's alive." The cantina's other customers turned to regard him.
"Get a hold of yourself,"
the man told Obi-Wan under his breath. He called for the cantina owner.
"Pour him a drink, a real one, and put it on my tab."
Riding the table, he urged Obi-Wan back into his chair and lowered himself onto an adjoining one. The cantina owner brought the drink and set it down in front of Obi-Wan.
"Is he all right?"
"He's fine," the man from Mos Eisley said.
Aren't you, friend? Obi-Wan nodded. Heatstroke. The cantina owner seemed satisfied.
I'll bring you some more water.
Obi-Wan's new friend waited until they were alone to say,
You really all right?
Obi-Wan nodded again.
Really?
The man adopted a conspiratorial voice.
You want to remain all right. You'll keep your voice down about Vader, understand? You'll keep from asking questions about him too. Even in this force-forsaken place.
Obi-Wan studied him. What do you know about him?
Just this. I have a friend, a trader in Hardwoods, who was on Kashyyyk when the Imperials launched their attack on a place called Kachirho. I guess he was lucky to get his ship raised and jumped. But he claims he got a glimpse of this guy Vader, ripping into Wookiees like they were stuffed toys, and going to lightsabers with the Jedi who were on world.
The spaceport worker glanced furtively around the cantina.
This Vader, he toasted Kashyyyk, friend. From what my friend says, it'll be years before a piece of Rosher goes up the well.
And the Wookiees, Obi-Wan said. The stranger shrugged forlornly.
Anyone's guess.
Placing a few credits on the table, he stood up.
Take care of yourself. These desert wastes aren't as remote as you may think they are.
When the water arrived, Obi-Wan downed it in a gulp, shouldered his rucksack, and left the cool shade of the veranda for the harsh light of Anchorhead's principal street. He moved in a daze that had little to do with the glare or the heat. As impossible as it seemed, Anakin had survived Mustafar and had resumed the Sith title of Darth Vader. How could Obi-Wan have been so foolish to bring Luke here, of all worlds? Anakin's homeworld, the grave of his mother, the home of his only family members. Obi-Wan gripped the lightsaber he carried under his robe. Had he driven Anakin deeper into the dark side by abandoning him on Mustafar? Could he face Anakin again? Could he kill him this time? From the far side of the street, he shadowed Owen and Beru as they moved from store to store, stocking up on staples. Should he warn them about Vader? Should he take Luke away from them and hide him on an even more remote world in the Outer Rim? His fear began to mount. His and Yoda's hopes for the future dashed, just as the Chosen One had dashed the Jedi's hopes of bringing balance to the Force.
Obi-Wan.
He came to an abrupt halt. It was a voice he hadn't heard in years, speaking to him not through his ears, but directly into his thoughts.
Qui-Gon, he said.
Master. Realizing that the locals were quickly going to brand him a madman if they heard him talking to himself, he ducked into the narrow alley between two stores.
Master, is Darth Vader Anakin? He asked after a moment. Yes. Although the Anakin you and I knew is imprisoned by the dark side.
I was wrong to leave him on Mustafar. I should have made sure he was dead.
The Force will determine Anakin's future. Obi-Wan, Luke must not be told that Vader is his father until the time is right.
Should I take further steps to hide Luke?
The core of Anakin that resides in Vader grasps that Tatooine is the source of nearly everything that causes him pain. Vader will never set foot on Tatooine, if only out of fear of reawakening Anakin.
Obi-Wan exhaled in relief. Then my obligation is unchanged. But from what Yoda told me, I know that I have much to learn, Master.
You were always that way, Obi-Wan.
Qui-Gon's voice faded, and Obi-Wan's fears began to dissipate, replaced by renewed expectation. Returning to the dazzling light of Tatooine's twin suns, he caught up with Owen, Beru, and Luke, and kept silent watch over them for what remained of the day.
This is Jonathan Davis.
We hope you've enjoyed this production of Star Wars: Dark Lord, The Rise of Darth Vader by James Luceno. This program was produced, directed, and abridged by Kevin Thompson. Executive producer, Jacob Bronstein. Star Wars: Dark Lord, The Rise of Darth Vader is a production of Lucasfilm Limited, copyright 2005. All rights reserved, used under authorization. Music composed by John Williams. Music publishing by Warner Tamerlane Publishing Corporation and Bantha Music. Music master production, copyright 2005, Lucasfilm Limited. This has been a Random House audio presentation. All rights reserved.